Country Day, and I got to, you know, my whole dad's, my, it was like a family reunion there, and we tackled that issue, and it was really encouraging to see the solidarity between the ranchers, the farmers, the white ranchers and farmers, and the Indian, and the tribes. And so my point is that the land can bring us together. It doesn't have to divide us. The land can help us make relatives of each other, and maybe will be a real fulfillment of some of the American mythology.
All right. That's a great note to end on. As usual, never enough time, Jackie. So thank you so much for joining us, Jacqueline Keeler, Yankton, Dakota Navajo writer, activist here in Portland, for sharing your thoughts today. And stay tuned for more great programming, Political Perspectives, coming up. Richard Heinberg, this is Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, as always, Paul Rowland.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
Hi, I'm Shahid Hamid. With each passing year, the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. become more and more necessary to remember. With this in mind, the World Arts Foundation and Kate Boo Foundation members would like to invite you, your family, and friends to their 31st anniversary and tribute to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Monday, January the 18th, broadcast live from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Highland Christian Center in Portland. As in years past, there will be a variety of local and regional choirs, performers, and entertainers, all paying homage to the work and legacy of Dr. King and our efforts to keep his dream alive. So remember, Monday, January the 18th at the Highland Christian Center, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., and of course, right here on KBOO FM radio.
The greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival, running from January 15th through February 8th. Real Music explores the lively interplay between sound and image, music and culture. Opening night, January 15th, will be Roxy the Movie, directed by Frank Zappa. Filmed over three nights in December 1973 at the Roxy Theater in Hollywood, Roxy the Movie encapsulates the qualities that made Frank Zappa a revolutionary musical pioneer. That's January 15th at 9:15 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the films and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland. It's 9:02, and here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, on Political Perspectives, Richard Heinberg, senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, speaks on our renewable future and an analysis of the fossil fuel supply and climate risk. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints spends the entire hour with celebrated poet Martin Espada, who will read from his latest book of poems, Vivas, to those who have failed. And at 11 o'clock on the KBOO Bike Show, Leah Benson of Gladys Bikes and Annalisa Fish, owner and head practitioner of Endurance PDX, discusses how to make your bike ride easier and as pain-free as possible. And once again, thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support of this dear radio community radio station. We really appreciate what you do, keeping KBOO radio on the air, and please continue to consider joining up as a member. Thanks very much, and here's Richard Heinberg.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Our Renewable Future, Richard Heinberg. On a cool November Sunday, the hall of the Little Lake Range in Willits, California, filled with members and supporters of WELL, Willard's economic localization. 11 years earlier, many of them had come to hear Richard Heinberg after reading his book, The Party's Over, Oil War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies. The 2004 Canadian documentary, The End of Suburbia, featured an interview with Heinberg, and it became an inspiration here as well as for the emerging international transition town movement. Arguing that modern life as we know it will end as easy oil reserves begin running out and climate change does not allow us to burn the rest, the transition town movement focuses on the interrelated issues of energy and economy, and also all the positive projects of local self-reliance that are already underway. Richard Heinberg's talk on Our Renewable Future is set among the frightening news about accelerating climate change. However, his message is serious but positive. He asks how our daily life will change as we fully embrace the era of renewable energy. How will we need to shift the ways we use energy, offering both opportunities and challenges? This ongoing community discussion came full circle for Willard's economic localization, since Richard was one of their first inspirational speakers shortly after they formed in 2004. Here is Richard Heinberg.
How many were actually here? Quite a lot of you. Well, I'll try not to repeat myself too much. I'm sure it all had to do with energy. And the reason for that is that energy is really everything, and we take it so much for granted, but energy is what enables us to do all the things that we do as human beings. Without energy, we could literally do nothing. And we have used energy in different forms throughout our existence as a species. For the vast majority of that existence as a species, we used energy in renewable forms, whether through food that we hunted and gathered, or food crops that we grew, or firewood. And we exerted energy into our environment to change it, to get what we wanted and needed, by way of muscle power, either human muscles or animal muscles. Through much of our history as a nation, we actually had a horrific institution of slavery, which was really all about capturing intelligently directed muscle power. And that required an epic war to bring that practice to an end. But during that century, the 19th century, we also made a historic switch from relying primarily on firewood and muscle power to relying on fossil fuels. And that shift from renewable energy to fossil fuels was absolutely epic. It changed everything about our economy, about the way we lived. You know, you've probably had the experience of running out of gas in your car and having to push your car off to the side of the road. That was a lot of work, right? Well, now imagine pushing your car 20 or 30 miles. How much work would that be? Well, obviously that would be a heck of a lot of work, something like 6 or 8 weeks of hard labor. But we get that done for us with a single gallon of gasoline for which we're paying $2.50 or in change, whatever. So imagine how cheap that energy is in comparison with muscle power. You know, if you could get somebody to work for you for 6 or 8 weeks hard labor for $2.50, imagine how much you could get done. This is why and how we have mechanized just about every economic process we possibly could over the course of the last 150, 200 years. And it has given us enormous economic advantages. We, instead of having, you know, literal human slaves, now we all have energy slaves. The average person has 100, 200, 300 energy slaves doing all the things for them that otherwise might be done by muscle power, whether it's moving them around or heating them or making their food or communication, what have you. Obviously, we're doing a lot of things that we weren't doing before just because, you know, it would have been absurd to try to do it without these energy slaves. Now, there are a couple of problems with this story of advancement and success based on fossil fuels. One of them is the fact that burning all of these fossil fuels is creating a nightmare. And we're only seeing the very beginning of that nightmare right now, which of course is climate change. And this is not a climate change lecture per se, but if you haven't been to a climate change lecture or you haven't read a good book about it, you certainly should, because this is the most important thing that's going on in our lifetimes. And again, we're only seeing the tip of the melting iceberg, the rapidly melting iceberg in this regard. It's going to change just about everything about our world over the course of the next few decades. We have to move off of fossil fuels because of the absolutely apocalyptic consequences of continuing to burn fossil fuels and put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We're basically performing an unprecedented chemistry experiment with the Earth's atmosphere and oceans. We have no idea what the consequences will be, but it looks so far as though they're going to be pretty, pretty bad. The other reason we have to move off of fossil fuels has to do with the fact that fossil fuels are simply depleting non-renewable resources. And I'm going to spend a few minutes sort of updating what I probably had to say 11 years ago with regard to the process of fossil fuel depletion, because this is something that I have spent a lot of time studying, and we at my organization, Post Carbon Institute, have studied very energetically. So this is kind of a schematic presentation of our situation. We extract oil, natural gas, and coal using the low-hanging fruit principle. We go after the cheapest, most readily available resources first and leave the more expensive to extract, nastier, more polluting stuff for later. We've been doing that from the very beginning. And it's starting to be later. You know, the easy stuff is no longer readily available. And as we start at the top of the resource pyramid and move down through conventional resources, we begin to extract more unconventional resources. In the case of natural gas, that would be shale gas that we produce by hydrofracturing, horizontal drilling. With oil, it would be tight oil or deep water oil or tar sands. All of that, you know, nasty, expensive stuff, that's in the category of unconventional resources. We're not going to run out of oil or natural gas or coal. It's simply not going to happen, because at some point, it will actually cost us more energy to get the stuff out of the ground than the stuff we get out of the ground will deliver when we burn it. And in fact, most of the coal, oil, and natural gas is in that category. So when somebody says, oh, you know, we don't have to worry about fossil fuel supplies because there's, you know, untold amounts of the stuff still to extract. Well, that's true. But the question is, how much can we extract economically? Well, that's a moving target because it depends on the price. You know, if we're willing to pay, let's say, $300, $400, $500 a barrel for oil, there's a lot of oil that we could get out of the ground that we wouldn't otherwise. But in that case, we'd be extracting oil that would have a very low energy payback in terms of the amount of energy that it would cost to get it out of the ground. Those are some of the complexities of the situation. Now let's move to some more specifics. When I was here 11 years ago, I was talking about the the depletion of conventional oil. And the forecasts from many very credible petroleum geologists suggesting that conventional oil production would reach a maximum and start to decline sometime over the last 10 years. And that's in fact what happened. Regular conventional oil has not been growing since 2005, 2006. Where we have seen growth in oil production, it's been in the unconventional category. So instead of simple vertical onshore wells, which are relatively cheap to drill, this is where the oil industry is going today: hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling. And globally, most of the increases in production that we have seen over the past 10 years have been in this category. And the U.S. has led the way. In North Dakota and Texas in particular, we've seen tens of thousands of new wells drilled over just these past few years. Why so many wells? Because these tight oil wells don't produce an enormous amount per well. And they also deplete and decline very rapidly. So in the very first year after drilling, the rate of production from a typical tight oil or shale gas well declines by about 65 or 70%. So if you want to maintain the overall rate of production or grow production, that means you have to drill and drill and drill. There's a drilling treadmill. I'm not going to talk tonight so much about the environmental impacts of hydrofracturing, but I do talk about it pretty extensively in my book, Snake Oil, which came out a couple of years ago. And again, this is a subject about which a lot of research has been done just in the last year or two, showing the health impact to communities, to not only to humans, but also to livestock, wildlife, and so on. But the problem with fracking is not only the environmental and health impacts, but also the fact that it's just not very economic. It's very expensive. So how is the industry managed to mobilize the drilling of tens of thousands of wells in a very short period of time? Well, it's partly because we've had a kind of unique financial environment over this last number of years. Remember, this got its start around 2007. Well, what was going on in 2007, 2008? We had an epic financial meltdown. And the response to that on the part of the Federal Reserve and US federal government was to lower interest rates practically to zero, which meant that if you have money in a savings account, it's making almost nothing. So that means that everybody wants to invest their money in stocks or bonds or something else other than savings accounts. So that's like a bubble machine. You know, that's why we have the stock market at record highs. It's not because the U.S. economy is going gangbusters. It's because, you know, basically people don't want to leave their money in a savings account, and where else can you put it? So these junk stocks and junk bonds that were put out by the fracking companies, and we're mostly not talking about big oil companies like Exxon and Chevron and BP. We're talking about much smaller to mid-size oil companies, and dozens of them. Investors were willing to put their money there. And of course, these companies also needed to borrow money from banks, which they could easily do because there were low interest rates and there was lots of money to borrow. So even though the companies themselves were often losing money on actual production, they've managed to stay in business for the last number of years. But that is changing. The industry itself is changing. Because of the shift from regular conventional oil production to unconventional oil and gas production, the costs to the industry have been skyrocketing at a rate of almost 11% per year. And that was the main reason that oil prices shot up during the period from around 2009 to 2014, and were stuck around $100 a barrel, unprecedented high, persistent oil price for a number of years. What happened was the frackers actually overproduced over the short term. It's kind of a complicated story as to why that was, but the incentive for them was to lease as much land as possible, to produce as much as they could, as quickly as possible, in order to show their investors that they really had the capability, that there really was the resource underground. But by doing so, they eventually drove the price of oil down well below the cost of production. So oil prices have been in the $40 to $50 range over the last year. And really, oil production in North Dakota and Texas is only profitable if oil is over $100 a barrel. So all of these companies are losing money hand over fist. Only about 1% of wells in North Dakota are profitable right now. So these folks are hanging on by their fingernails, you know, waiting for the bills to come due, waiting to see when the banks start to call in the loans. And essentially, the oil and gas industry is skating on very thin ice right now, which, of course, if you're concerned about climate change, is good news. But on the other hand, from an economic standpoint, that does have consequences. As we encounter more energy constraints as a result of all of the things I've been talking about, increased costs of production and so on, that tends to lead to higher energy prices. But high energy prices cause the economy to start to ratchet down. Demand starts to decline, and actually oil demand has not grown very much over the last 10 years because oil prices were so high. So economic contraction then leads to demand destruction, which ultimately leads to lower energy prices, which again we've seen the collapse of oil prices. And that leads to lower energy investment, which is what's happening in the oil world right now. The oil companies, whether large or small, are cutting back on upstream investments in exploration and production. So inevitably, we will see declining oil production and natural gas production over the next few years. And in fact, we're already seeing it. U.S. natural gas production, which had been going gangbusters and growing by leaps and bounds, has now leveled off and is just beginning to decline. Some of the older plays that where the fracking boom started, like the Haynesville play in Texas to Arkansas, sort of on the border of Texas and Arkansas, that's declining. The Barnett play, which was the very first shale gas play in Texas, that's declined by about half already. So the only place where shale gas production is still growing is the Marcellus region in Pennsylvania, and that looks like it's going to peak out and start to decline within the next year or two. So in oil, the Bakken formation in North Dakota is already declining. Altogether, U.S. oil production is down by about 500,000 barrels a day in the last few months. So that's going to lead to more energy constraints, and around the wheel we go, you know, and each trip around the wheel will result in more economic hardship. All of this is really an argument for moving away from fossil fuels as quickly as we can to alternative energy sources. And that's the main topic that I want to address today. And everybody who understands energy at all, everybody who understands climate change, believes and understands that this is what we have to do. This is our big job for the remainder of the 21st century. This is where the action is in the energy world. Solar and wind are the subjects of most of the conversation because that's where the growth potential lies. Now, there are other potential renewable energy sources, including hydropower and microhydro, geothermal, tidal power, wave power, and biomass. But these are all limited in one way or another, supply limited in one way or another. So most of the excitement in the energy world is about the potential for solar and wind. And at the same time, even though the fuel is free, there are some advantages of solar wind and wind. Obviously, it doesn't cost. Sunlight and wind do not themselves cost any money. The technology that we use to harvest them, of course, does cost money and requires materials and energy for construction and deployment. There are a couple of other challenges with solar and wind. These are uncontrollable intermittent energy sources. With, let's say, coal. Suppose you have a coal power plant. Well, obviously that's bad news in lots of ways, but from the standpoint of the utility operator, it's pretty simple. You know, you need electricity, you just shovel in coal whenever and wherever you need it, and you've got the electricity. With solar and wind, you don't know necessarily when the wind is going to be blowing. You have a better idea of when the sun is going to be shining, although clouds are a little less predictable. But you may have, you know, days and even weeks when the wind isn't blowing very strongly. And in the winter, of course, there's less sunlight, and there can be days or sometimes even weeks of lots of cloud cover. So this is a serious problem. Also, there are environmental costs with renewable energy. Obviously, they are much smaller than is the case with fossil fuels. With coal power, for example, here in the U.S., we spend approximately $500 billion a year in terms of health and environmental damage from coal power. This is from a study, Harvard University, 2011. We don't pay that money up front. It doesn't all go through the one channel. It goes through our health system. It goes through environmental remediation in all kinds of ways. But that's a heck of a lot of money. It's a lot of damage. Another challenge with our renewable energy transition is that it's going to be different from our last energy transition. You know, the fossil fuel revolution was driven primarily by economic opportunity. And we were just piling new energy sources on top of existing ones. We still use firewood, maybe not as much as we did back in the 1850s, and certainly not as much on a per capita basis as we did in the 1850s, but we still use firewood. We just added hydro and coal and oil and all these things. What we're talking about doing now is replacing existing energy sources, and our main energy sources, the sources of about 80 to 83% of the energy that we're using right now. We're talking about replacing with renewable sources. So that's inherently a pretty big job. Now, on the plus side, on the advantage side, we're not going to have to replace all of that because there's an enormous amount of energy that's wasted in generating electricity from coal or natural gas. That's a very inefficient way of producing electricity. Something like 60% of the energy in the coal and natural gas is lost in the process of producing electricity. Now, that's not the case with wind and solar. These sources of energy go to electricity directly. So those losses are something that, you know, we're not going to have to produce as much energy altogether in order to produce as much electricity as we want to use. Okay, so that's on the plus side. Now, on the minus side, we don't use all of our energy in the form of electricity. I was kind of surprised, actually, when we started doing research on this, as to how little of our energy we use in the form of electricity. It's only about 22% in the United States, about 18% globally. And I should mention, by the way, that this presentation tonight is kind of a preview of a book that I'm working on, co-authored with David Fridley, who is a staff scientist in the energy evaluation program of Lawrence Berkeley Labs. So when I talk about the research that we've been doing, it's not just my readings and philosophizing. It's also what David has been doing at Lawrence Berkeley Labs for the past few years. And it's been quite an eye-opener for me to have the opportunity of picking his brain on a regular basis.
That was the first part of a one-hour talk by Richard Heinberg on Our Renewable Future. He spoke on November 15, 2015, at the Willits Little Lake Grange in Northern California. Richard is Senior Fellow in Residence at the Post Carbon Institute and has written extensively on energy, economic and ecological issues, and oil depletion. He's the author of 12 books, including some of the seminal works on our energy and environmental sustainability crisis. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Our Renewable Future, Richard Heinberg, How to Get There from Here. This is the second part of a one-hour speech. Here now is his three-level plan for the transition to renewable energy. He's touching on food production, transportation, housing, manufacturing, steel and cement construction, mining, the internet, and much more. All in 24 minutes. He calls this the economic transformation for the remainder of our lives. Richard Heinberg.
This energy transition is going to be a big deal. And if we want to accomplish it successfully, it's going to be good for us to think of it in terms of levels of difficulty. I'm not going to call it stages because stages would imply, well, we're going to do stage one, then we're going to finish that and go to stage two, and so on. We're actually going to have to start with all of these things at the same time, but it's good to have some sense of the low-hanging fruit, right? What we can do right away that won't take so long. Just about everybody agrees that where we should start with the energy transition is coal. Basically, legislating coal out of existence, replacing all of our coal power plants with solar, wind, geothermal, what have you. That's kind of the no-brainer. Coal, obviously, is the worst climate offender, and we could do this, okay? How about home heating? In this part of the country, most of us are using natural gas. In the eastern part of the U.S., a lot of folks are heating with oil. Obviously, all of that is fossil fuels. How to do it with electricity? Well, electric heaters, the kinds of space heaters most of us are familiar with, are extremely energy inefficient. But there are better options. By the way, the strategy of electrifying more of our energy use has got to be front and center with our overall strategy for the energy transition. Remember, most of our renewable sources of energy produce electricity directly. So we have to take advantage of that bonus that we're getting wherever we possibly can by using energy in the form of electricity, wherever it's possible. So in terms of heating our homes, how about air source heat pumps? They're much more energy efficient than electric space heaters or baseboard heaters or what have you. Millions of these could be put in service across the U.S. Instantly, we could do away with a lot of our reliance on natural gas or oil. Now, obviously, somebody's got to pay for all that. So each household, presumably, would have to pony up a few thousand dollars. We're talking roughly $3,000 or $4,000 to install one of these things. So the energy transition is not going to be free. Same thing with transportation. We could drive electric cars. Electric cars are on the market. But the average person does not buy a new car every year. This is a partial solution, but it's something that is possible. It is gaining momentum. More electric cars are coming on the market every year. But if we get out of our cars and share transportation or walk or ride bicycles, that's immediately cheaper and more efficient, obviously much better. How about cooking? Again, electrify everything we possibly can. How about our food system? Our food system is a huge energy user, and we're going to have to transform our food system in pretty profound ways, because currently our food system depends a lot on oil for inputs like transporting, you know, fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides to the farm. The fertilizers are mostly made from natural gas. The pesticides and herbicides are mostly made from oil or oil byproducts. So all of that has got to change. Organic agriculture is our option there. So we need basically to transition our whole food system to one that is not dependent on these fossil fuel inputs, and it's also much more localized. So instead of shipping our foods for, you know, average of 1,500 miles, we're growing more of our food locally and reducing processing and packaging, because this is actually a surprisingly large contributor to the energy footprint of our food. Okay, that's the easy stuff. And if we did all of this easy stuff, we could probably reduce our reliance on fossil fuels by, say, let's say roughly 40%. It's really impossible to total it up and get to an exact number, but let's say 40%. So what's in the next swath here of the harder stuff? Well, here we're talking about not just coal, but also natural gas. Now, why is that going to be harder than coal? Because right now we use natural gas peaking plants in order to buffer the intermittency of solar and wind. If suddenly, you know, you don't have the wind power or the solar power, but you have electricity demand, you fire up the natural gas peaking plant. And that's actually going to be a more important strategy as solar and wind make up a larger and larger proportion of our total electricity supply. But if we want to get natural gas out of the picture, because it's still a fossil fuel, what do we do in that case? Well, we're going to need energy storage. Batteries are actually an inherently inefficient way of storing electricity. Now, everyone's gotten excited in the last year or so about the Tesla batteries and some improvements in battery storage efficiency and cost and so on. Yeah, batteries are getting better, but if you look at the theoretical maximum efficiency of chemical storage of electricity, it's still way below other options for energy storage. Our most efficient option from the standpoint of cost is storing electricity in reservoirs. You know, just pump water uphill when you have excess electricity into reservoirs and let it flow back downhill through turbines. But we don't have enough reservoirs. You know, you have to have the right topography in order to make optimum use of that energy storage. So, you know, right now, we really don't have the possibility of storing enough energy for long enough to get rid of natural gas. In the transport sector, we talked about electric cars, but cars are inherently energy inefficient. I mean, in most cases, with an automobile, you're talking about a couple of tons of metal and glass and plastic and rubber that you have to move around in order to transport one human being, right? That's inherently very inefficient. So there, we have more efficient ways of moving people, like public transportation, but it's going to be more expensive to build a lot of public transit, and it's going to take some time. So that's why this is in the second level of difficulty. We've got to do it and change our habits and our expectations about mobility. But what about all the stuff that we ship around the world? We could add kite sails to container ships, and they do make the ships much more energy efficient, but they don't do away with the need for fuel oil altogether. Okay, so really, if we're going to do away with fuel oil altogether and go to sailing ships, we're really talking about reducing the scale of global trade quite dramatically. That's why this is not in level one. We're starting to get into harder stuff. And how about our buildings? Okay, slapping an air source heat pump onto the side of a building is a good idea, but that's not enough either. We're going to have to redesign and retrofit millions of houses and public spaces across this country to make them much, much more energy efficient. Now, there are ways of doing this. In Germany, there's what's called the passive house movement. And it's actually using technology and principles developed here in the United States back in the 1970s during, you know, the energy crises of many years ago. But basically, this is using daylighting and super insulation and heat sinks and so on to reduce the energy usage in a typical building by about 90 to 95%. So why don't we make all of our building regulations require passive house standards? This is starting to be done in Europe. Not so much here in the U.S. so far. There are 20,000 passive house buildings that have been constructed in Germany. Here in the United States, more like 20. So that's level two. And if we do all the stuff in level two, we might be able to get to like 80% reduction in reliance on fossil fuels. So now we're down to the really hard stuff. How about building construction? What do we use for building construction? A lot of steel and concrete. Well, it turns out that steel and concrete are really fossil fuel intensive. Making cement, we do it in giant kilns that are heated to about 1500 degrees centigrade. And we do that with fossil fuels. Now, in principle, it would be possible to produce that kind of industrial high heat using hydrogen or electricity. But it would probably be a lot more expensive, and we would have to completely redesign the process. Nobody's doing that right now. We could be making rubber with tree sap again, rather than using oil for synthetic rubber. But how much tree sap do we have? And, you know, how much would it cost to do that? So we have to look probably at reducing the total material throughput of the economy, you know, the amount of cement and steel and mined materials that we're using. A lot of manufacturing is done with electricity, so that's good. We've already got that electrified. But the materials that we use in manufacturing very often come from mining, and those mined materials are very often shipped very long distances. All of that is dependent on fossil fuels. Now, again, we could imagine these giant mining machines running on solar or wind electricity, probably not with batteries, because batteries just don't have the energy density. But, you know, we could have electric cables running to these machines. It's possible to do. But again, nobody's doing it now, and it's likely to be more expensive, and it will be very difficult to do this on the scale that we're currently doing it. And then what about the materials that we use that are made from fossil fuels? All the petrochemicals and plastics that make their way into, you know, everything from clothing to containers to communications devices. So extracting all of those materials or finding renewable substitutes, we have a lot of work to do. We're talking about a world of smaller scale in terms of production and consumption, probably more labor in many production processes. We're talking about much more recycled natural materials, reusing and repairing things rather than throwing them away. Essentially, what this looks like is a completely new economic model. Over the last centuries or so, we've gotten used to the economic model called consumerism. And this started back in the 1920s and 30s and 50s, really. We had then the problem of overproduction. With cheap fossil fuels, we could make stuff faster than people were accustomed to buying it. So the solution to that was to talk people into buying more stuff than they thought they needed. So we invented an advertising industry to do that, and consumer credit industry, loaning people money so they could afford to buy stuff that they couldn't buy. We created a consumer economy characterized by planned obsolescence. The whole idea was to get everybody to buy as much stuff as they could. Well, we're moving into something that's almost entirely the opposite, a conserver economy, where the incentive will have to be somehow, one way or another, to get people to reuse, recycle, and remanufacture stuff. Now, how do we do that financially, economically, in terms of jobs and so on? This is to be determined, but it's going to be a big deal. This will be the economic transformation of the remainder of our lifetime. Now, when David Fridley and I looked at the communications sector, we found this is definitely level three. A lot of the assembly processes, again, use electricity. No problem, you can power those with solar, wind, or whatever your source of electricity, no problem. But the high heat processes for producing the materials and the sources of the materials themselves are a big problem. Whereas now we buy a new iPhone every year or 18 months, that's not how it's going to work in the future. If we want to maintain something like an internet and cloud and cell phones and all of this kind of electronic infrastructure, we're going to have to do it in a way that is probably on a smaller scale, that looks a lot more like what the internet looks like in much poorer countries. Imagine getting a smartphone and expecting it to last for 10 or 20 years. That's the future. And then there are some things that just don't work in the renewable future. And aviation is in that category. Yes, we probably could have airplanes that run on sophisticated biofuels or on cryogenic hydrogen. But in the case of hydrogen, it would require a complete redesign of all aircraft. In the case of biofuels, we're talking about fuels that have an inherent high cost from both a dollar and an energy perspective. It will take more energy to produce these fuels than they will give us when we burn them. So we'll be having to subsidize the production of those biofuels from other energy sources, which means they're inherently very expensive. So we could have vestiges of air travel with, you know, helium blimps or, you know, a few airliners running on hydrogen or biofuels, but it's not going to look anything like the aviation industry, commercial aviation industry that we see today. And you can get some idea of where we're headed just in terms of the relative energy efficiency of different transport modes. You know, rail turns out to be very efficient in terms of moving tons per mile. We actually need to rebuild our rail networks in this country. and rely much less on trucking. Now, when we get to the point of fully transitioning our food system to where it's entirely localized and organic, if we do this intelligently, there could actually be some side benefits, because it's possible to use permaculture and organic production in ways that build topsoil. Now, we've been mining topsoil using industrial agriculture, and that's actually been a very large net contributor to greenhouse gases. But if we begin building topsoil, what we're doing in the process is actually capturing and storing carbon from the atmosphere back into the soil. And so there could be a net benefit from a climate standpoint to this energy transition. And at the end of the day, when we've finished doing the level three really hard stuff, we could be in a situation where not only are we no longer adding CO2 to the atmosphere, but we're actually reducing the carbon load. Now, how much energy are we likely to have at the end of this process? That's an unknown. Again, there are too many variables, but most of the variables that David and I have looked at are ones that seem to militate in the direction of less usable energy. The question that a lot of people are asking is, could renewable energy enable us to maintain our current lifestyle? Well, as the Global Footprint Network has documented, our current lifestyle entails using the world's resources at about four times the sustainable rate. I'm talking about how we live in North America. So asking if we can maintain the North American lifestyle with renewable energy is basically asking, can we use renewable energy to continue living unsustainably? And the answer to that question is, well, not for very long. So we should be aiming for a much lower energy consumption level anyway. And if we aim for a lower level, we're much more likely to be able to meet that level of demand with intermittent sources like solar and wind that are backed up by other renewable sources like hydropower, geothermal, and the rest, which can be used as baseload, right? If we're demanding current level of energy consumption, then we create all kinds of engineering problems in terms of buffering that intermittency with storage and grid upgrades and source redundancy and so on. But you can get rid of most of those engineering nightmares just by reducing energy demand pretty dramatically, like 70 to 90%, because then you can rely on these other sources, again, like hydro, geothermal, and so on, for baseload, and then use solar and wind for electricity that you can use when it's available. And you can schedule and time your energy consumption according to electricity availability. So that's the cheapest way of engineering the energy transition. So this is what our energy future is likely to look like. Less overall energy. Much of it will be less controllable. We will be less mobile altogether. We're not going to have aviation, and other forms of mobility will be constrained. And therefore, our economies are going to have to be much more localized. Altogether, we're not talking about a plug-and-play transition where we unplug the coal power plant, plug in a solar panel, and continue living exactly the way we're accustomed to. We're talking about a civilization reboot. As we do this, we're going to have to think about energy equity also, because all of this is going to cost a lot. So how do we pursue it? Do we just let those folks who can afford to have solar panels and wind turbines, install their own energy systems, and the rest of us just rely on what we can still afford until it runs out or it's no longer available. That's one possible pathway to a renewable energy future. It will be an extremely dysfunctional pathway because all it will do is exacerbate the already extreme economic inequality that we see in this country and around the world. So if we don't want that future, we're going to have to plan for energy equity. And that's another whole lecture. So the opportunities here are sizable. We could have a much more energy efficient economy. We could have, in fact, a more acceptable quality of life, even with much lower energy consumption per capita, if we plan for the transition and make it in a coordinated way. Obviously, we'll have a much more stable climate if we do this. Obviously, we'll have greatly reduced health and environmental impacts and costs, and we will be able to remove carbon from the atmosphere. But it's going to require a lot of investment. That means we have to make this a top priority as a society. It will require regulation. I said earlier, we have to basically regulate coal out of existence, and then do that also with oil and natural gas. And we can't do that until we have alternatives ready to go. We're going to have to change behaviors and expectations, and it's going to ultimately give us an economy that looks very different from the consumer economy of the 20th century. So it's a big job. And right now, we don't have folks at the national political level talking very much about it. In fact, we have one whole party that denies that this is even a possibility or a necessity. So we have a lot of work on our hands. And where we can do this work on the local level, we can get started. And therefore, our economies are going to have to be much more localized. This is going to be a difficult, expensive, and long process. We can't do it all in 5 or 10 years. But we have to get started, and the longer we wait, the more difficult and expensive the process, and the more likely we will end up at the end of the day with a political and economic system that's much less functional than it would otherwise be.
That was Richard Heinberg. He's senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and has written extensively on energy and ecological issues. Even his first book, The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, caught the attention and imagination of many. He has been quoted and interviewed by Reuters, AP, and Time magazine, and on TV in the US, Canada, Australia, and by Al Jazeera. Heinberg has also appeared in many films and TV documentaries, including Leonardo DiCaprio's 11th Hour. His animations, Don't Worry, Drive On, Who Killed Economic Growth, and 300 Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Minutes, have been viewed by more than 1.6 million people on YouTube. He was recorded and filmed by TUC Radio at the Little Lake Grange in the small former logging town of Willits, California, on November 15, 2015. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to TUC Radio featuring Richard Heinberg on KBOO Portland. Stay tuned at 10:15 for Flashpoints, today spending the entire hour with celebrated poet Martin Espada, who will read from his latest book of poems, Vivas to Those Who Have Failed. And at 11, it's the KBOO Bike Show, where today the topic is pain-free cycling. Stay tuned for that. And all that coming up just after one little announcement, and then Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO.
Tune in Wednesdays for an afternoon of jazz. Hosts of Jazz Lives, A Jazz World, and Jazz in the Afternoon play the very best in jazz music. From the historical to the present, and jazz of all stripes, swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.